Welcome on to a special Saturday edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Danny and I had some time, figured we would record after that great Game 6 between the Hawks and Wizards, and also to discuss the Warriors moving on into the next round. Danny, how are you doing? You get a chance to catch both games last night?
Absolutely, and they were both interesting in their own ways. I think since we're going to start with the Hawks, I mean, what kept on being fascinating to me throughout this entire series was the way that both coaches were choosing the five men that were on the floor at a given time.
Yeah, it was. We saw for the first time in this game that Atlanta really was able to attack the Washington small lineup with Paul Pierce at power forward, to the extent that Pierce actually had to be taken off the floor late in the second half. Usually the MO from Whitman had been start off going to that small lineup really at about the 8 minute mark or so of the second quarter and finish it out with Pierce and Porter at the forwards. But Millsap really started abusing Pierce in the post. They were really looking for him. Pierce wasn't able to defend the cross screens that they were using for Millsap very well. And Millsap was even able to get on the glass a little bit. So Whitman had to go back to a big lineup with, I think, about 3-4 minutes left in the half. And that was especially damaging because he really didn't have Marcin Gortat available. He struggled with food poisoning over the 2 days leading up to the game and wasn't able to offer too much.
Yeah, and that was a big factor in it. And that, of course, came into play later on. But something that Kevin Arnovitz tweeted out, which was kind of remarkable in some ways, is that the Hawks starting five, which you and I have talked about for the entire run of this podcast, has been so good together. In the first half, they played 11 minutes. That's a lot. And in those 11 minutes, they had a plus 13, meaning they outscored the Wizards by 13 points, which, considering how close this game ended up, is pretty amazing. And it tells you the strength of the core of this Atlanta team.
Yeah, it is. And 11 minutes for the starting five is a little bit closer to what it really should be, I think, in the playoffs, where you're essentially, I think, you should be able to get the first 6 and last 6 minutes of each half with your starters in there. So that 12 minutes is about the baseline. Coach Bud has not been doing that. A lot of times he'll come back with Al Horford with, you know, 3 minutes left in the half. And that's because he likes to get those guys in there with the reserve units. And while it is kind of rough to not have the starters together as much, it's also difficult for him because this isn't a team where you can have a star or two, you know, that you stagger. Where if you're Oklahoma City, you can say, all right, you know, for the first 3-4 minutes of the second quarter, we're going to have all bench guys in with Russell Westbrook. We'll be able to get by offensively, running everything through him during that time. And then we can go back to the starters and you kind of use up all of your reserve minutes with a star alongside them. For Coach Bud, he can't do that. They would really get smashed. So he's got to have 2 and hopefully even 3 starters on the floor at all times, and that makes his job a little bit more difficult to keep that starting unit together.
I should also note that while that is a completely logical path for the Oklahoma City Thunder, it is not something Scott Brooks did most often.
No, that's true. I mean, or you know, it could be the Clippers.
Or the Warriors.
Griffin, or even, I mean, really, the first guy to start that strategy, at least in my memory, was Phil Jackson would always have either Jordan or Pippen on the floor for those 90s Bulls.
Right.
So that said, I mean, with Coach Bud, he still could extend the starters a little bit more. And I mean, one thing that I am being struck by more in these playoffs is coaches have sort of this pull towards, I don't necessarily want to call it the conventional, but it's more sort of the way that they think things should be, if that makes sense. Like, for example, Golden State waited until Game 3 to put Klay Thompson on Mike Conley. And I think it was good for Kerr to challenge Curry throughout the regular season to guard his position. They had, under Mark Jackson, that hadn't been the case. It was always Klay Thompson on the point guard. But on the other hand, Klay Thompson's better at defending point guards than Steph Curry is, and he did a great job, basically made Conley disappear in the last 4 games of that series. So that's one example. I think that Coach Bud getting lots of minutes for the reserves, sort of this kumbaya style, everyone integrated, no stars sort of thing for the Hawks. That's the way he prefers to play. And when that wasn't working, or and I think ultimately he really knows that that's not what gives him the best chance to win, but yet he wants to kind of win his way, the way that, you know, is the quote-unquote right way, that rather than the way that's the most effective. So, I mean, and a lot of times it's the same thing with coaches going with a big lineup, two bigs, instead of going small, because there's just this idea that fundamentally you should be having two big guys out there. What do you think of that?
I agree with you for the most part. The kind of funny thing to me about that is that one exception to that in this series was Dennis Schroeder playing crunch time. I don't think that that necessarily is something that Budenholzer thought was you know, his preferred path, but he used it a lot in this game.
Well, I don't know. I think it kind of is. I think it ties into the whole, well, our reserves are just as good as our starters, and we're all one big unit here, and there's no preference, and if you're playing well, then you should get to stay out there, although the definition of Schroeder playing well is perhaps a different one for me than Coach Bud has. But then, on the other hand, that really worked for Kevin McHale, so you can't say that there's only one path. It's just more of an observation than necessarily a criticism, I guess.
Since I don't think we're going to go through this game in the wonderful, painstaking detail that we go through in other ones, one thing I wanted to hit early, because I know it's a point that you make very well, but we haven't talked about a lot on the podcast, is the use of the quick two. You want to kind of explain to people what that is and the flaws in it?
Yeah. I mean, it's basically, you'll always hear, once you're under, at the point where if you're down by three or more and you're at a point where after you score, you're going to need to foul, a lot of announcers will always say, all right, now you don't need a three here. You know, you can get a quick two. And there's this perception really by doing that you're keeping the game alive, right? If you're down three, you're down four, even if you're down five, which is even more criminal, you say, okay, we get a two, we're still in it. Now they have to make their free throws. Whereas if we miss a three, we're not getting any points, and now it's over. But there are a number of fallacies with that. The first one is really, really overrating the chance of making the quick two. And there's this idea that, oh, they're going to be guarding the three-point line, we'll be able to score the quick two. But really, at least 50% of the time, if not more, the quote-unquote automatic quick two, you end up shooting a shot that's contested. You know, if you go in for the layup, you got a guy there at the rim, you're pulling up for a floater. It's not really that much more efficient to try to get a two in that situation than it is normally. I think that's the fallacy. And even if you're going to say, all right, we have a 60% chance of making this two, then after that, you're almost invariably going to foul someone who's an 80% or more free throw shooter, who's going to very likely make both free throws. He certainly has a better chance of making both free throws than you have of making your quick two. And then even so, in some ways, your best case scenario is you're right back where you started, down the same amount after you trade twos, and then you more time has run off the clock. So psychologically, I understand it, because you think, okay, you know, now we're in it, we're still trying, like we have a chance, and we foul, maybe they'll miss these free throws, or, you know, we'll still have a chance to tie, but really, if you're down three, and then really if you're down four is the one that's a killer, right? I mean, you make a two, all they got to do is hit one, then all you can do is tie it with a three, or if they make both, you're still just completely out of it. And you think you're still in it, but that's giving you the best chance of being in the game until the end, not winning the game. What gives you the best chance of winning the game is to go for the three under almost all circumstances, and then maybe if they really, like, take that away, you have someone standing right under the basket. But to have the primary option of the play be to try and get a two instead of a three when you know you're going to have to foul afterwards, I think it's just the math just does not work on that.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, the big difference is the expectation of success. I mean, I think that if you can generate a 80 or 90% or even 100% two, then yeah, that changes the calculus, because then...
That doesn't exist, though.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, people are like, oh, it's a three, it's unlikely, and all that kind of stuff. But really, the difference between them, and this is something that we're seeing more in the NBA, is that, you know, the difference in likelihood of them going in, depending on the quality of look, it's closer than people think. And because it's worth an extra point, especially if you're thinking in the free throw context, you can't make 3 points on free throws unless somebody messes up pretty badly. So you have that option there, and you have so much more upside too. I mean, I think that's the other part of it, is like when you're in the situation where you're going to be fouling, then you want to be going, you know, you want to be kind of aiming more, if you want to call it quote unquote high risk, because that's what you need to get back in a game.
The other thing too is, I mean, so think about it, right? Let's say you score your quick two, and then the other team has an 80% free throw shooter. There's an 80% free throw shooter. There's a 64% chance they're going to make both. And usually it's going to be a better than 80% free throw shooter who's getting the ball. Now, maybe you can say the quick two is a little more defensible if you believe that your team, A, has an awesome ability to deny the ball to the other team's best free throw shooter, or B, you have a full court press that you think is really going to work. But now NBA coaches have gotten a lot smarter. They will take timeouts in that situation and advance the ball. So you can't use that, takes the whole press and the 8 second count out of it. And then in sideline out of bounds, it's much easier. You have a lot more space to get the ball to one of your best free throw shooters. So it's really hard to deny. And I mean, a lot of teams don't even do a good enough job of denying the best free throw shooter, or even trying to anyway. So if you're going to go for the quick two, you better have a great belief in your ability to do that, or at least try to do that. So yeah, I mean, it's an infuriating strategy. Washington went for two quick twos, missed both of them, and really they ended up lucking into getting a chance to tie just because there was a turnover. And then, I mean, so yeah, it's almost the exception here that proves the rule, right? So Washington is down four, I think, with about, you know, under 30 seconds left. So Washington goes for the quick two. Beal misses the layup. Beal gets the rebound. Then they pass it around again for another 7 seconds. Wall misses the layup. And with 18 seconds left now, the Hawks get the rebound and call a timeout. So that's two chances. They could have been going for a three. Instead, they go for a two. And it's not easy. Like, both of those layups were heavily contested, and they were missed. You know, those are shots that are 50% shots, maybe 60% shots or so. And down four, they were just extremely lucky when the ball was inbounded to Horford, that A, they were able to get a steal, which is pretty rare that that's going to happen. Horford, instead of just accepting the foul up four, which he should have done, he tried to pass it to Korver, and it got deflected and stolen. Then Washington, they're still down by four. They were able to go down to the other end. Another missed layup. Porter got the rebound. He missed the layup. Garrett Temple gets the offensive rebound and his foul. I mean, it would have been nice to see him go for a three there as well, though when you're in a fast break, maybe it's not realistic to expect him to slow up. And Temple makes both free throws. They're within two. Horford misses one out of two. And then they're able to get that last shot for Pierce that you know, was just a second late. Obviously, just an unbelievable shot by him. A shame that wasn't just a little bit earlier. But you look at all of the things that had to go right for them to even get a chance to tie when going with that strategy. Whereas if you go for a three when you're down four, you make that three. Granted, you know, it's tough. You probably only get about it's probably a 30% shot, maybe 35% if you run a great play. But then you're guaranteed to get a chance to tie instead of all these things that had to go right with the quick two strategy.
Yeah, and also, as you mentioned, they missed a bunch of shots during that stretch. You know, they had, four?
It shows the fallacy of the quick two. Yeah. You're going to, like, it's not an automatic shot by any means.
Yeah. And so just watching it live, did you think the Pierce shot was too late?
I thought it was good.
I thought it was a little late.
Yeah. I mean, it was, in sort of like a temporal standpoint, it seemed like, all right, wow, this is a lot of stuff that's happening here for the amount of time that's left. So I knew it was going to be close, but it looked like live that he got it off in time. I mean, so what do you think of these? A lot of people were saying, oh, man, like replay, I can't believe that they took it away. Like this fairness over fun, it's just not. But, like, to me, I don't like that criticism. I think the replay getting it right is more important. What do you think?
In this circumstance, I am firmly in support of replay because it was the last play of the game. It was a play that you could objectively evaluate. There is no subjectivity to whether the ball was out of his hand or not. You know, it's not anything. Absolutely. It's nothing like that. And, you know, so if you can get it right, which is an important thing, and you can do the whole assumption of, you know, you go with the call on the, you go with the call in the court, and unless you can overrule it, which they could in this case. And yeah, I mean, there's no subjectivity to it, and you can get it right. So, I mean, in those circumstances, I hate it on things like clear path. It should be an intent call. I hate it on a lot of other circumstances. And it's not a situation where, you know, oh, it affects other things. You know, they would have played differently if they knew they were down three as opposed to down four, you know, things like that. It's the last play of the game. So not, I have zero problem whatsoever. It would be a little bit different if, you know, there was theoretically a concept of a foul or something, but again, it's the last play of the game and it's a shot whether it was off in time, so you're not really dealing with any of that stuff. So I completely support it in this case.
Yeah, I mean, it was called good on the floor. Nobody would be complaining if it hadn't been called good on the floor, right? I mean, let's say it wasn't called good on the floor and he had actually gotten it off, then
a false negative, yeah.
People would be complaining about that. And the other thing, too, is like, okay, oh, you know, yeah, it's definitely an emotional letdown to have it not count. But, okay, so we should, let's say the refs had gotten it wrong and had been in his hand for 0.2 seconds instead of 1. Is it okay to overturn it then on replay? How about 0.3 seconds? I mean, where you have nowhere to draw the line there. You get the call right. I mean, I think on those plays, that's what's fair. And I mean, that's, if you're a competitor out there on the floor, you want to win, or lose by what's fair and have them get it right as much as possible in those last 2 minutes, at least for me.
Yeah, I'm firmly on board with that.
So a couple other things that were interesting in this game, both teams had over 40% offensive rebounds in the first half.
It was crazy.
It was really a crazy game. It was extremely low foul, but yet every team was getting a ton of offensive rebounds and just couldn't convert them and couldn't hit a shot. You know, it was also very slow paced because there were so many offensive rebounds. The possessions were taking a long time, and so people were complaining, "Oh, this is such an eyesore." But the Hawks actually scored over a point per possession in the first half, and Washington wasn't too far behind. So I think that those complaints were a little bit overblown. In the third quarter, Washington just was not able to get any spacing. That's when the Hawks' starting lineup really was able to get them up to that 15-point lead. I think it was 62-47 at one point. And then Whitman went to the bench, and Kevin Serafin had a really nice game and maybe was a little bit overextended, but you can't say that he played any worse than Nene did, although Serafin doesn't quite have the defensive awareness. He was getting taken advantage of early in the fourth quarter there. But he played pretty well. The matchups were real interesting as well. The Wizards, and I'm not sure why they did this, they went with Wall guarding Carroll, and then they had Beal on Teague or Schroeder, whoever the point guard was, and then Porter was guarding Korver. And Porter did a nice job on Korver. He got some looks late, but wasn't able to convert them. I thought Beal had done a great job, though. Wall, to me, is one of the best defensive point guards. So I'm not sure what the rationale was there. I'm sure that there was one. You know, maybe even just Wall's injury and trying to guard pick and rolls. But that matchup ended up really hurting them when Wall, who I had been helping a lot, and Carroll said this in the post-game interview, Wall had been helping off of him a lot, so he knew he was able to cut him, and that's those two buckets in the last minute by Carroll going backdoor around a pick and roll with Teague and Horford were really the killers in this game.
Yeah, they really were. And one thing that I like to think about and talk about with defenders is that there is a substantial difference between on ball and off ball, just in terms of the action that is happening around you. And some of what I saw with Wall was just his instinct to help. And it's something that I've seen that I was whining about with Curry in this playoffs, which is that sometimes a guy who's comfortable on ball playing off ball will do things like over helping or, you know, be susceptible to things like cuts because that's not that, I'm not saying they've never done it before. Obviously, John Wall's defended guys off ball for plenty of time in his career, but they're less comfortable with it. And I think that's part of what Carroll was seeing, was that Wall was a little bit more susceptible to that than somebody who spends more of their time off ball.
So I think it is worth going through kind of the last 2 minutes of this game. Millsap was able to get – Pierce actually started defending Millsap better when they went to him. He was able to stop him down on the block and then push him off the block. Millsap made a really tough ISO J on Pierce that gave the Hawks a lead. Then when Washington came down – and this is – Wall is a wonderful player. I think we talked about him before as our pick for the fourth best point guard in the league. But he definitely has stuff to work on, and his lack of three-point shooting when he's off the ball, and that's something that he's going to have to do a fair amount, when, especially with Beal, someone who's going to evolve even more into a secondary ball handler in the years to come. He missed a wide, wide, wide open three, and then there was another possession where the infamous Nene, where everyone was just so upset at him for going to the basket. What they had set up on that play was a dribble handoff to Beal. Coach Budenholzer put in, as he's done a great job of all series and all playoffs even, put in Kent Bazemore to guard Beal. And Bazemore did a great ball denial on what was supposed to be a dribble handoff going middle to Beal. And then at that point, Nene faked the handoff. It was covered. And he's had success, actually, with that move before. It wasn't a ridiculous move. But Horford did a great job of not getting fooled by the fake handoff. He was able to stay with him. But a big part of why Nene wasn't able to get past Horford was that Carroll was right in his lap, because Wall is not really a good enough shooter. And then Nene ended up missing the layup over a great contest from Horford. So I think when you look at Wall this summer, certainly he's going to be beating himself up over those two cuts. But also I think, you know, the thing for him to really work on for this to become a great offense is for him to be able to shoot the three-pointer better, especially off pick and rolls, but also spotting up. If this is going to be a Washington team that builds on their offensive improvement in these playoffs with a small unit, his shooting is going to need to be a big part of that.
And as we've talked about, and a lot of other, you know, people have talked about, the part of the benefit of being a good shooter is the effect that it has on your opponents, and that, you know, the idea of gravity and everything like that. And so for Wall, not only will it lead to more and better shots for him in that sense, it will also lead to more space for everyone else. And I think that's exactly what you were getting at with the idea of, you know, that Damari Carroll was over there. And that's something that the Warriors have succeeded at. You know, it's one of the benefits of having the crazy backcourt they have, is that the other players feel so much more attached to their covers. And so what that means is that if you can trust the other guys to handle the ball, and that's actually what the Warriors had to do, it's kind of the reverse of the Wizards, is that the Warriors needed everybody but Curry to be able to handle it enough to take advantage of that increased spacing.
I shouldn't say that Wall, you know, was terrible in this
No, not at all.
He was great, and one of the adjustments, which I think we had talked about in previous shows, was that the Hawks put Carroll on him, I think in large part because he was able to be a little bit better of a helper off the ball. We saw Teague guarding Beal for most of this game, and what Wall was able to do, I mean, his intelligence is increasing every year. He was able to, when Carroll would kind of help off of him getting ready on like a floppy set. For those who don't know, a floppy set basically is where you have a shooter starting under the basket and then receiving a screen to go out to the wing from one of the big men. And they'll usually do that on both sides. And one common tactic to stop that, especially if the point guard is not that great of a shooter, is the point guard's man will kind of help off onto one of those shooters on the wing when he comes off the screen. And so Carroll would have his head turned, getting ready to do that as they're running the action. And when Carroll would turn his head, Wall would just blow by him. So he got that two or three times very effectively on Carroll. It's a smart play for a lot of point guards, who, especially ones who are more shooting challenged. So it's not like Wall isn't doing anything to combat things, but it makes it a lot easier if you can just shoot that shot, too.
Yeah, it just adds another dimension that defenses and individual defensive players need to think about.
A couple more little items here. Pierce, was by all accounts really devastated after this and emotionally drained. And what a clutch series from him. I mean, that shot that he made was just ridiculous. He basically Euro-stepped to his left from the three-point line off one foot, but just, you know, old man game, still totally in control, and a shame that that shot was just a little bit late. But he was talking about he wasn't sure if he's going to come back. He does have a player option for over $5 million next year. I really can't remember just about any time when someone has had money on the table like that and has retired. I mean, maybe they'd retire if they are at the end of a contract, but when you actually have the option to come back, now $5 million isn't that much for him compared to how much he's made in his career, so maybe he'll decide to walk away at that point. But I expect him to be back. It would be quite a rarity for anyone to leave guaranteed money of much significance on the table.
And also, I think that if he wanted to play somewhere else, I think he could get, to me at least, he could get a similar value to that on another team that has a similar need.
Yeah, maybe even more, frankly, for especially on a one-year deal. You know, and there's a ton of teams that have cap space. So I expect him. I mean, he was obviously really devastated, and he had a telling quote too that. Really, it wasn't so much about him as the toll it takes on his family. He goes home, and he is upset, and he doesn't have anything to say to, like, his wife and his mom because he's miserable, yeah. You know, and who knows for how long that's going to be with a competitor like him. So maybe that's and also for these old guys, especially, just doing what it takes to keep your body ready when you're that old and just basically stave off decline. It's so hard to do, and you can get out there sometimes on your good days, but making sure that there are enough good days just from a treatment standpoint and a workout standpoint is so difficult.
One thing from what I understand of Pierce is I do not expect him to do the whole waiting around for half the season and then making a decision. From what I can tell, even if he's, you know, going to take a little while to work himself into shape, I feel like he'd want to start a season with a team.
Well, and I also think that from a money standpoint, I mean, he has the $5 million option for next year. So with that being the case, it's unlikely that he could get that much if he comes in towards the end of the season. So, I mean, maybe he could. Maybe there'd be a team that would leave their exception open or something like that. But it's unlikely that a team that would actually be able to compete for the championship would leave that amount of money open for him. So I expect that he probably, I mean, it seems like he really enjoyed Washington, and I think my guess, not knowing anything personally, but my guess just from the outside looking in is that he'll be back. One last question on Washington before we move on. Has this playoffs changed your opinion of Randy Whitman at all?
Yeah, I mean, it has, because he's done such a nice job. I mean, what I think about certain play calls, particularly those, you know, side out of bounds and things like that, they've had a couple of huge play calls, and he showed a much greater willingness to change his rotation and to do, you know, kind of to do whatever the team needed for success. I mean, that was one of my big criticisms of him, as somebody who was around this team for a lot this year, that he wasn't willing to, you know, take advantage of some of the stuff. He was more the way he was using Gortat, the way he was using Nene, and then in the playoffs, all of that shifted. And so you never really know what that means moving forward, but that is very encouraging, because you want a coach to be able to maximize the talent that they have, and I feel like he got a whole heck of a lot closer to that in the playoffs than he did in the regular season.
Yeah, and frankly, Otto Porter didn't play like this all during the year. You know, he was out of the rotation, and he was for a reason. He wasn't shooting the ball like this. And frankly, I think he may have just had a hot streak that, you know, it may be sustainable with more work, but just given his current talent level, I don't know that, like, the way he was shooting threes in the Raptors series and the first half of this Atlanta series was something that was going to continue. And he regressed with his shooting those last three games or so. And was not really able to be effective from three-point range. But, I mean, on Whitman's ledger, complain as you will about the offense, this is a team that really has been a top-five level defense mm-hmm. now for the last 3 years. And he certainly deserves some credit for that.
And he's done it without a truly high-end rim protector as well, which is usually a very important component.
Yeah, that's true. And they still, even with the small lineup, they're able to defend pretty well. I mean, and you can't, you know, he's done that with a shooting guard starting that is in years one through three. Rookies are almost invariably terrible defensively, and he's been able to get enough out of Beal that wasn't the case. Wall has really improved as a defender under his watch. I mean, they've never really had a true lockdown guy on the wing or, as you said, at the rim. So I think he's gotten a lot out of the talent defensively. Now, there's been a lot of discussion that too many mid-rangers were taken, but they were able to change that in the playoffs, and he had some encouraging statements after the loss that that's something that they're going to try to continue to evolve towards, shooting more three-pointers as time goes on. So, I don't know. I mean, I think deserve is a word that's probably thrown around a little bit too much with coaches, where you say, oh, did this guy deserve to be fired? Did Monty Williams deserve to be fired? You know, it's a little bit, deserve doesn't have anything to do with it. It's much more, do you think you can upgrade or not? You know, is this guy continuing to improve? That sort of thing. What do you think is best for the team? Not, you know, what does this guy deserve? But I think, you know, there's nobody out there that I would point to as someone who I think would be an immediate upgrade. You could maybe say there'd be someone more offensively creative, but then does that guy maintain the defense? I think that, you know, especially with how they've done in the playoffs and the defense, I would be okay with Whitman continuing to be the coach. And, you know, he got an extension, and it should, I think he'll do an okay job next year.
Yeah, I agree with you that you're running a risk. And, you know, the only way that I would do it is if you know, if you had somebody lined up, but there aren't that many people. And the only other dynamic there would be theoretically, you know, the whole, if you thought that Kevin Durant cared that Kevin Ollie could be his next coach and that you could do that, I think if that really would increase the chances, then that's something you consider, just because the chance of getting a generational player is worth that kind of a risk. But again, this is very nebulous, very speculative. The other thing that I was thinking about with this is I was always big on the Nerlens Noel train, and that was a guy that they could have taken over Otto Porter. And I've been really impressed with what Whitman has done for their defense. Part of the reason I brought up the rim protector is because they could have gotten him. And what I've been fascinated with in my own brain is how good this defense could be if they had that true guy. I mean, Gortat's been done well for them. He didn't play in the fourth quarter a lot in the regular season, and he had his sickness issues in game six. But I feel like there's a whole nother level that this defense can go.
Yeah, we'll see about that. And long term, I think the aging of their big men and replacing those guys, both Nene and Gortat. Nene did not have a good playoffs overall, other than maybe one or two games. So that's going to be a concern, certainly. I mean, those guys are important for the screening that they do in the offense. But aside from that, especially with both of them out there, the spacing can get pretty tough. So with that being the case, I mean, for them long term, with Porter, Wall, and Beal being younger, you know, if they can't get Durant, finding someone else in free agency next summer as a big guy who can really grow with those guys, especially someone who can finish off the pick and roll and protect the basket, will be key. All right, let's move on to Golden State Memphis. I think that many people have used the phrase order has been restored, and I think that was very much the case in this series. To me, a lot of this game, although Memphis did get back into it, was decided in the first quarter, and specifically in that first 6 minute stretch, which was the only 6 minutes that Tony Allen played. He didn't look right at all to me. What did you think?
I thought he looked very limited, in a sense that I actually felt bad that he was out on the court. I'm a huge supporter of just, you know, what he can bring to a team, but it's really hard at this level, particularly when you have the talented players that the Warriors have, to be out there. He said he was at 60%. Let's give him the full, you know, the full credence of that. It's really hard to stay on the court offensively and defensively with this kind of talent if you're at 60%. I don't care who you are.
Yeah, especially when you're reliant upon your energy to do that. And the Warriors, to their credit, really were able to take advantage of him because of all the cross matching. We discussed that on previous programs. They started off with Bogut guarding him and Memphis really didn't have much chance to get good offense. Allen went 1 out of 2 on jumpers. They tried to have him screen a little bit, but he wasn't really setting very effective screens, not something that he does a ton of. And still, you know, even if you were able to get past the screen, then you still have to go into the rim, and Bogut's just waiting there. Bogut controlled the defensive glass during that first part. But the worst part was, you know, they gave up 19 points in that first stretch with Allen out there. Klay Thompson was really able to get loose, and so was Curry. And the reason was Allen a lot of times was hanging out on the baseline trying to get some cuts, do what he could offensively. But then with the cross match, Klay Thompson is usually out on the wing when the shot was taken, or he was guarding Conley away, 23 feet from the basket. And then with Allen having the assignment on Thompson, he's got a 23-foot deficit to make up while Klay Thompson is sprinting to the wing for a three-pointer. And not only that, but when you have a hamstring injury, you can't really sprint. I mean, and there's not that much dead sprinting that happens in a basketball game. Sometimes in certain roles you can get by. You know, Paul was able to get by with it at times. But in that situation, you got to be able to sprint back. And he really just was not able to do that. The Warriors got a ton of transition points in that first 6 minutes, a lot of it due to the fact that he wasn't able to get back. And then, you know, not a couple times also he wasn't able to get a loose ball and then rotate to his man. So that was the one reason why the Warriors were humming early. And then the other one was that they tried to switch up and put Zach Randolph on Harrison Barnes to keep him out of pick and rolls with the 1-4 pick and rolls with Green and Curry that had been killing them in the previous game. So the Warriors got wise to that very quickly. Barnes was able to attack Zach Randolph off the dribble and then pull up for, you know, the jumpers that he's been hitting in this series with those ISOs. That's been an element that's really been important for the Warriors when they've had some droughts. He was able to blow by Randolph a couple of times, especially off of screens. And with that being the case, and the Warriors would also screen for Barnes as well. Randolph, not a guy who's going to be able to stay with someone coming off of screens. And so Memphis had to just go back to having Randolph on Green again. And they did a little better after that, but again, it showed, you know, they tried an adjustment, and that was one that just didn't work. The Warriors pounded that one into the dust.
Yeah, to me, the big takeaway from this series is a concept that, what part of the reason I love the playoffs is the concept of moves and counter moves. And so you're trying to do things to keep the opponent off guard, and then they adjust, and then you adjust back, and you start to do, you know, maps off that, and you start to do different things. The challenge for Memphis, some of this is injury related, but most of it is not, is that they don't have the personnel to really do that. They don't really have the counter moves. They have their move. They're good at it. It's unusual to be as good at it as they are, but they just don't have it. I mean, if you're Tony Allen's having problems, you replace him with Jeff Green. Jeff Green creates a lot more problems too. They don't have a lot of those things. And so you think about a guy, you know, like Mike Miller added to their team last year, that he could play some four, he could play some three, who's a guy that a defense has had to pay attention to. And so as presently constructed, I think Memphis has a ceiling, and that ceiling isn't bad. You know, that ceiling is very good. They made the second round of the playoffs. They've had some really nice runs. They made the Western Conference Finals a few years ago. But it would be very hard for a team with this construct to win a championship. And not every team is designed to win a championship. Not every team will win when only one team does every year, and usually they have, you know, that MVP caliber guy. But, you know, so what the, for me, the question is if you're Memphis, can you do anything about that? And, you know, and at the same point, if you can't, are you happy with how things are?
Well, I think they're a lot happier than they were in some of the nadirs that this franchise has had.
Exactly.
Since 20 years ago. So, I mean, I think if you have a 50-win team, even the team that has, I mean, they won 55 this year, they won 57 in previous years, probably would have got up to about that level last year. I actually thought that last year's team was their best team because of that resurgence of Mike Miller that in that 1 year. He was having a knockdown shooter who was able to play, actually got their offense up a little better, and they took a great Oklahoma City team to 7 games, although, I mean, people say, oh, if Randolph hadn't gotten suspended, they might have made it. But they got they got blown out in that Game 7, and they were getting blown out in the Game 6, so I don't know that that would have made a huge difference for Game 7 having him in there after he punched Steven Adams. But, yeah, I mean, it's tough, but I think especially in a smaller market, the idea of tearing it down and only championships matter becomes a lot more difficult because I think just financially you're not going to be nearly as successful. Now the issue, though, is that they have to retain Marc Gasol. I'm sure we'll get into that a lot more on another podcast of what kind of contract he should get, what he should do, and whether it makes sense for him personally to stay or not. But that's probably beyond the scope of what we want to get to today.
Yeah, I agree that it is. And the other thing that I wanted to get to that was very concerning for me in terms of the Warriors is that at the beginning of the third quarter, they were in a closeout situation. They had a lead. They had been controlling the game. And while some of that is related to, you know, Tony Allen not coming back into the game, so they didn't get to take advantage in transition the way that they had, they came out to me very flat. And that was flat in terms of what they were doing offensively, flat in terms of, if you want to call it, effort. And to me, that is a danger when you're dealing with a team that has very high aspirations. You know, it does happen. I'm not going to say, oh, that they're not going to win anything because of that. I'm almost definitely going to have them as the favorite in the next series. But that is the type of thing that is a problem because, as we saw on Thursday, those stretches can be dangerous because every team that's left is good enough to take advantage of it.
Well, I actually disagree with you. I don't think that they were really that bad in that stretch. I think that they definitely got some real tough breaks in that third quarter, especially from the referees, and Memphis was able to get to the line a ton. That's always a big problem for Golden State. I mean, I think if you look at the games that they lose when the other team shoots a lot of foul shots and then their own rhythm and break is disrupted, I think that ends up being a problem. There are definitely some pretty questionable calls. I mean, there was one charge on Curry where he was on a back cut. Conley came over to help, and Conley made contact with him for the quote-unquote charge, I think before Curry's first foot had even hit the ground, not even his second foot, and a charge was called. That's yet another call that I totally hate there. But and there are a few on Bogut and Green. That's just the vagaries. Sometimes you just get calls that go against you. I thought they weathered that pretty well. They also were just missing a lot of shots. Curry actually just couldn't buy a two-pointer in the last few games of these series, despite the fact that he hit 8 threes and probably should have set the record. The record's 9 in the playoffs, and he had like 2 or 3 misses late of wide open ones. And then, of course, he hit that awesome, it was listed as 62 feet. I think it was much more than that because it was inside the 3-point line. So, really, that shot was unbelievable.
Well, and that was the swing. I mean, it's funny, you don't often think, especially the two of us, you know, about how, you know, the emotional impact, but that sequence was so huge because the Grizzlies, it was as close, I think it was about 4 points, is what my brain is, and Jeff Green went up for 3. I personally didn't think he was fouled, but I thought, you know, I could definitely see why the fans thought that and why the players thought it was close. Then not only do you not get that call, but the ball happens to bounce to Stephen Curry. He has about 1.4 left and just lets it fly and gets it. And I will use this time, since I have never done this on the podcast, to stump for something that Ethan Sherwood-Strauss and I have both separately and together argued for years, which is that shots from beyond half court should be treated like when you get fouled shooting a shot, which is that it counts if it goes in. It does not count if you don't, because
Just in the box
because
score.
Guys,
oh, yeah.
Because guys do not shoot those because it hurts their shooting percentage. I have
at least in the regular
season. Exactly. And so, like, why, if you're the NBA, those shots are incredibly exciting. Everybody likes it. And yeah, obviously it's kind of lucky and fluky, but so are a whole bunch of other things. And I feel like guys would shoot them a lot more if it had no negative consequence. So just let them happen.
To me, I don't think so. I mean, it's a shot, right? Like, that's what you are measuring in the box score, is number of shots. The problem so often is in the interpretation, not the statistic itself.
Right.
If you're worried about your field goal percentage, and I mean, the reason you're worried about your field goal percentage is that you won't be perceived as good of a player, or you might not get paid as much. Well, that's a problem in measuring. So when we as fans talk about field goal percentage, someone should say, all right, what is their field goal percentage without shots from beyond half court, you know, or without total heaves that really just don't reflect your quality as a shooter. I mean, the problem is in the interpretation of that stat. I don't think that it's fair to just take it out of there. I mean, it's to measure the number of shots, and especially because you're trying to measure how good a team's efficiency is. If you didn't score on that possession, you didn't score on that possession. So, I mean, it's the problem to me is in the interpretation, not the statistic, and that's where the change needs to come, rather than just in the box score where the guy now has to decide whether he was beyond half court or not to figure out whether he's going to count it.
I definitely think fair interpretation of it. I think that it does make it a less perfect measure. I do think also, I'm fine with that, you know, with the idea of that affecting points per possession stuff a little bit.
And your solution is easier, but it's more...
It's less perfect.
But to me, it's more just a pet peeve that for everyone, the measurement of these box score stats, a lot of times, doesn't match up to how good a player actually is or what actually wins games.
Yeah.
And to the problem with players kind of stat manipulating, the same, like triple doubles is another one.
Ugh.
That's like ridiculous, right? Like we're going to be total, or double doubles, or we're going to be fixated on this guy is good because, you know, people in the Middle East thousands of years ago decided that 10 was going to be the first number that's going to be expressed in double digits. Now we've determined that because you had 10 instead of 9 or something, that's the limit to make you a good player. So it's really, to me, it's more about how we interpret the stats, and if players could have more faith that their value is being interpreted properly, and we've obviously made great strides in that of late in the last 5 or 10 years, then you wouldn't see this sort of stat manipulating behavior, because that just happens to be what we decided we're going to count for things that frankly don't have much of a correlation with winning a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Double-Double on the Warriors is definitely a factor in that.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm tired of people saying, oh, how can you say Gasol hasn't been that good or something, like he led the league in double-doubles. Well, okay, so if he had had 25 points and averaged 9.9 rebounds per game, he would be a worse player than if he averaged 18 and 10.1 rebounds per game. I mean, come on.
Well, and the whole idea of counting stats, I mean, the other one with me with that is Russell Westbrook. I mean, I'm a huge Russell Westbrook fan. People who can look at my background with that and anything with that, but when you have the ball in your hands every single time, you're going to get counting stats. And so the people who were looking at that and like, I mean, I saw that in kind of the same way in terms of stat manipulation in that sense. I mean, they needed it, right. But so.
All right, we're probably starting to ramble here. Before we end, what's your prediction for tomorrow, Clippers at Rockets, Game 7?
I still think the Clippers are going to win. I think that there wasn't anything in that Game 6, as remarkable as it was, that convinced me that the Rockets are a better team. I think that the Clippers win.
I agree with you, and we both picked the Rockets in 7. I don't know about you, before the series, I don't know about you, but my thinking was Paul was going to miss the first two games or at least be totally hobbled, and they'd win both of those two, although the Clippers were better, that they wouldn't be able to overcome that.
Exactly. I didn't think the Rockets were a better team than the Clippers when I picked them. I just thought the Rockets were a better team than the Clippers without Chris Paul by enough to do it.
Yeah, and that they had home court. So it was, with that being the case, I think the Clippers will win as well tomorrow, now that it's gotten to a Game 7. And to build on your point from earlier, there wasn't anything about that Rockets comeback that makes me think that they're now a better team and that they figured something out. I mean, you want to have Josh Smith and Corey Brewer shoot 7 threes in a quarter? Go ahead, be my guest. You know, I mean, you want to give up open threes and layups at the rim to the Clippers and just hope that they miss them again? You know, go ahead and be my guest. You want to take James Harden out of the game for the last 14 minutes? Same thing. And it hasn't been all that effective except in really a couple of games in this series. And I think that having him back in there, I'm not sure that they can replicate the type of defense that they played down the end. So, yeah, I think it is home court. There is a daunting record for road teams in game sevens, but I think a lot of times that's selection bias and that home team has home court advantage for a reason and they're better. So I don't think that's the case. I think the Clippers are better, and I think that they will eke it out.
Yeah, we're on the same page. I wish we would pick against each other more often because that's fun, but hey, whatever happens.
Well, we picked against each other in the Spurs-Clippers series, and we know what happened there. So,
thank you.
Maybe you should just follow my picks for now on. All right, good. I've silenced Danny. That's a great way to end it. We'll be back tomorrow after that game is over to go in-depth, preview both the Eastern and Western Conference Finals. And we'll also start getting into some other content now that we don't have a game every day. Our first game will be on Tuesday, so we'll maybe start getting into some draft prospects, potentially previewing some teams, free agencies during the off season as we get into more days that don't necessarily have a game or only have one game. But until tomorrow, thanks for listening. I'm Nate Duncan. Nate Duncan NBA is my Twitter handle. Danny LaRue, same Twitter handle for him. Can subscribe on iTunes or at the Real GM page, and we'll talk to you all next time. Thanks.